Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. I'm Sandy Harper, here with my co-host Dick Reichman and two extremely special guests. Perry Eaton, who has just had an art show in Paris, and a member of the Alaskan entourage, because there were many Alaskan guests who came to help celebrate this amazing occasion. So, Perry, why don't you tell us a little about how it happened and what the experience was like?
Well, I mean, you know, if you're an artist and you have a solo show and it's in Paris, it's pretty good. you can't really complain about that. But I have to tell you, it was pretty incredible, actually. The country is so warm and friendly, and the show was wonderful. And I think I commented to one person about halfway through the grand opening, I looked at the soles of my shoes and they were absolutely clean because they hadn't touched the pavement in about 5 hours.
Well, what happened? The phone rang one day and it said, "Monsieur Eaton."
Well, actually. The show was sort of a culmination of a lot of activities that the Aleutic people through Koniag and the Aleutic Museum have done over the last few years. And this came out of a project in a coastal town, Bologna Simir, which houses a museum that has the great collection of Alphonse Panart. And I had been doing some work there. I'd actually been an artist in residence during a very large show of the collection. And a gallery owner in Paris had approached me and said, would you have any interest in doing a show in Paris? And I thoughtfully, you know, all of, I don't know, 10 seconds or so, I thought it through and said, sure. But such a show takes a lot of planning. It was about a year and a half before we, a little more than that, closer to 2 years before we actually had the show.
Yeah, and I know that your collaborator in the art show was Edward Curtis. Not bad.
Yeah, I had good company. My feet didn't touch the ground.
Well, maybe you could tell us, go back a little bit on how masks, of course, a part of your cultural heritage, but how you were inspired yourself to begin making masks.
The Kodiak experience is really different than some others in Alaska. The Aleutic people have pretty much been invisible for several generations, and the physical art of the island just didn't exist when I was growing up. And I'd always been involved in art and been an artist, but finding your own stuff was almost impossible. There were a few publications, obscure publications and things with some harpoons and odds and ends in it. And about 20 years ago, as an artist, I just said, wait just a minute. We were a strong culture. We had a lot of things going, and you can't have a culture without art.
No.
It just can't be.
So there was no residue of art? There was no museum? There was no collection where you could look at...
There was a museum when I was a kid. It was in a Quonset hut, and I remember an old broken down kayak frame and a dog sled frame kind of outside. And there were a few stone lamps, pecked stone lamps, and some stuff that had been dug up. I mean, that kind of stuff. But physical art, drums, regalia, clothing, tools, atlatls, and things like that didn't exist. Didn't know they were there. And it's only been in about the last 25 years. I would say actually after land claims, or more precisely, when the success of land claims became obvious and the people began following through and starting to really ask the tough questions. Who am I?
Of course. It's all about identity. So did you have stories from your parents or grandparents that helped lead you on the path?
Not of the nativeness so much. Mm-hmm. Lots of stories on the Russian side.
Uh-huh.
Lots of strength about the Russians. Orthodoxy, of course, is a very dominant cultural feature of Kodiak Native villages. And when you think about Kodiak and think about the history, and this Pinard collection is fascinating, 1872, that's when the mass left the island. Well, that's just after the sale. That's just after 67, when the sale, so you've got a changing of the guard and a different set of cultural values being superimposed on a people that fundamentally have assimilated Russian. The religion is gone. Orthodoxy is there very strong. The Creole, the mixed blood children are basically running the Russian American company, and you now go from this managerial position to being something in American culture called a half breed. So you really start over. And things native, I believe, were really sort of pushed away, particularly on the north end of the island, which were a lot of Russian settlements. Now, the south end of the island really is our bastion of culture. There's more speakers on the south end. They kept many of their old ways, and they're more what we would label today as traditional. The north end was much more of a commerce center. A Fog Neck community was the largest community on the island up until, after the turn of the century. Kodiak as a town didn't really take its dominance until pretty late in the game.
But who was more repressive of native culture, the Russians or the Americans?
My jury is absolutely out. Each had its own. Each had its own set of values. Each one had its own model of assimilation. In their own way, each was quite suppressive. Quite suppressive. And also the native community wanted to belong. I mean, you always want to belong.
Sure.
So there is a legitimate effort to assimilate and do certain things. And I remember as a kid, the one thing you didn't do is you didn't eat raw fish in front of in front of non-native people. That was fish heads, that was a real stigma thing. Of course, you had it in the kitchen, but you didn't do certain things.
And as you said now, early before we started recording, sushi is now what
it is. Oh, yeah.
Taken over.
It was wonderful when another culture came in and put value to raw fish. I went from a savage to a low-tide gourmet. It was wonderful.
It seems, Perry, throughout your life, you have found a balance somehow to walk in both worlds very successfully.
It gets interesting at times. I had some very difficult years when I was a teenager. And different sets of values, the upward mobility and the striving to always rise above. I can remember my teachers telling me, you're cheating if you don't work to your total capacity. And of course, what they meant was moving up the chain. Well, how far up the chain do you have to move before you're allowed to be satisfied? And a native community has a certain threshold of satisfaction that allows an individual a sort of a peace of mind relatively early. We don't have to wait till we're 65. Different set of values and struggling with those. If you're a successful fisherman, do you need a bigger boat? And do you need a bigger house? You've got more money now, disposable income. So should you build a new house? Do you need a new house?
Those are all good questions. I don't think we need a bigger theater, for example. It's quality.
It's a strange thing. And, of course, we as Americans today, we're the greatest consumers in the world. And, we buy a new rug when we get tired of the color. Do we need a new rug?
It's very good questions.
We need to support the economy, which if it doesn't grow.
We're actually taught that. That we're doing our part in consuming. There's this underlying thing about doing your part and buying American. It's not about savings. It's not about, quality. It's about where do you buy? Buy.
consume.
Yeah, Madison Ave becomes even more and more important.
That's right.
Yeah. But, you know, earlier, though, you were referring to, you said that you've always been an artist.
Oh, yes.
And always felt you were an artist. And now, of course, you're able to pursue that and be recognized as an artist. And yet, reading a little bit about you, when you decide to go to college, what attracted you to business and accounting?
You have to feed a family.
Yes.
That I had grown up on the fishing fleets. Mm-hmm. And I started commercial fishing with my father when I was 10, which was pretty common for my generation. And feast and famine of fishing. I mean, you could have a really, really fine, fine season and really do well. And then you could have a season where you literally went backwards. And I decided I didn't want that kind of excitement in my life. And so after 10 years, 12 years of fishing, I sort of backed out of that. And I wanted something more stable. Art in America and artists in America are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
America does appreciate art. I mean, that's a fact. But we don't take care of our artists.
That's very true. And also, I think you point out, art and being a regular human being are not necessarily separate.
That's correct.
You know, it's how you live your life with an artistic mentality.
I think that was one of the exciting things about the Paris show, is I was treated as Europeans treat artists.
Ah, and what does that mean?
It's different. I would walk into a store and in the neighborhood where the gallery was, and during the course of conversation, you know, it would come up, well, I'm an artist, and I got a discount. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. People, when I was an artist and resident in Boulogne-sur-Mer, I was staying in a little loft apartment, which was wonderful. And so I would go down and buy my bread every day and get whatever it was I was going to eat on a daily basis. I would shop like a European. And when the gentleman at the little meat market deli found out that I was the artist in residence, I got a little extra portion of this, and we rounded off the bill. And
Just the names of the streets in Paris are named after great literary figures and artists.
Sure. Yeah. It's a different culture.
Yeah.
It's a different culture.
And I also want to take advantage of Margie being here, who was part of the entourage who enjoyed and celebrated this wonderful event. So maybe, Margie, you tell us a little bit about how you guys all decided, hey, we're going to go too, and the experience itself.
I would be delighted to do that. Well, I've been a observer of Alaska Native art and culture all my life, and it's something that's very precious to me. But I've noticed within the last decade or so, this sort of resurgence of art across Alaska. Even in 1976, it wasn't when the bicentennial happened. I worked with the Smithsonian to take Alaska Native artists to Washington, D.C. And even back then, it wasn't as celebrated and cherished as it is in Alaska now. So I've watched this emergence with just great delight. And of course, Perry and I have been friends for, I'd like to say 20 years, but it's probably more like 40, and neither one of us are that old. But when I learned that he was going to have an art show, not just an art show, but on the left bank of Paris at the beginning of the Art Week, in Europe, this is huge. This is absolutely huge. And it could be the first ever solo exhibition of Alaska Native art in Paris. I don't know that for a fact, but it definitely could be. And so I, too, observed the way that the artist was treated in Paris. It was just extraordinary. They're held in high esteem. They're cherished as local celebrities, but as also local, but as people who are contributing mightily to the culture and to mankind. And the opening night, walking down the red carpets that were out, first of all, I found a lot of people look like me. And the people were taking pictures of me because I dress in a most Margie eclectic manner. But you know what I found on the left bank? There were a lot of people that looked just like me. It was
you mean
great.
They were competing hats?
Yes, exactly. They had fabulous hats. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But also, there was a lot of media present with microphones and speakers, and it was so incredible to watch this son of a fisherman from Kodiak just sort of nicely handling the mics and the media attention and answering the questions. And people were genuinely interested in the culture of Alaska Natives, and they were particularly interested in the art. And Perry answered each of the questions so beautifully. It was like having a university professor, except a living treasure there. And yes, Edward Curtis Prince. I mean, how much better can you get? It was great. He too is a treasure, isn't he? With his contributions. So it was truly, truly extraordinary. I wouldn't have missed it.
Who else was there, Margie? I know Jane and Vic were there.
Jane and Vic Fisher and Bob Waldrop and Mary and Alice Rogoff and Eleanor Andrews and the judge.
John Reese.
Sandy. And
were you amazed and surprised you had all these familiar friends there?
Well, I had a solo show in February in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Nada.
Nobody came.
No.
The Parisian factor.
It was the Parisian factor. Yes, indeed. It was spectacular, and it was spring, and it was beautiful. And there were so many sort of great Alaska experiences at the gallery. A lady who lives in Paris was there, and she used to live in Alaska, and asked where I was from, and I said Cordova. And then this marvelous Alaska experience, she said that her family had come to Alaska in the early 50s on a boat with the Smith family. That would be the Phil Smith family, not Mudhole Smith family. But anyway, her sister had got sick in Ketchikan, and so they were asked to leave Alaska Steam, and they really didn't have the money to stay anywhere. And so Phil's father, who was going to work for the predecessor to FAA, helped get the family settled in this little inn, and then when he left, they noticed that he'd left his hat on the chair, and the mother went to return the hat and realized it was full of cash, and that he had passed the passed his hat on the boat to get enough money for the family to stay for a week till a sister could get well. And there were just these great, extraordinary Alaska experiences. It was wonderful.
It does sound wonderful, and I'm certainly envious. But I was going to ask Perry, it was in France where they did, or Winnie the Mask from Kodiak had ended up. Mm-hmm. And so that must have been quite a catalytic moment when you did had the experience of going to see them.
Oh, yeah. A lady named Helen Simeonov had been the first Native person to actually go see the masks, the Pinard collection. And excuse me. And she had done that in '99, and she had shared some photographs with me. I think 3 months later was on a plane.
Wow.
And the collection was known to the scientific community, but it had never been embraced by the people. It had never been acknowledged and embraced, and Helen was the catalyst. She's the one that reached out and said, "This is part of us, and everybody needs to see this." And so she was the sort of the activist that brought the collection really to the forefront. I had known about it. I had heard a story when I was about 13 about how all the masks left. They took them away. And it was told to me by a Native woman, an old Native woman, and she was proud that they had been taken away. It was a good thing to be rid of.
To be rid of.
Oh, yeah. It was, again, that stigma of nativism in the 50s.
How painful that must have been.
Well, yeah. You know, you put yourself back there, and you're a participant. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the norm of the day, and that assimilation model in the American system was, you know, let's get on with the show here. Mm-hmm. And the native experience in Alaska is significantly different than the rest of the United States.
This is true.
And so you have these pieces. And, you know, there's 9 ethnic cultures in the state, and each one dealt with this assimilation issue and this thing sort of collectively differently. And Kodiak, you know, was real pivotal and very, very predominant in the Russian experience. And when you study the history.
What about today? Is there native art in Kodiak?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
There's a museum there now as well.
Oh,
as living contemporary
yes.
artists.
Yeah, we started a repository. Mm-hmm. Things were leaving the island. Teachers would have digs in the villages with a school, and the stuff would end up in the school. And when the teacher translated out, it went out with the teacher. Mm-hmm. And we were losing a lot of artifacts. And this is a wonderful debate, you know, where does art begin and an artifact end? France is having this wonderful discussion now about primitive art. And when you can put a name on a mask, is it the product of an artist, or is it a cultural artifact?
Very fascinating.
But on the island, the issue was we need to preserve it. And so with some of the Exxon Valdez money, they built the Aleutic Museum and Archaeological Repository is, I think, the proper name.
What about contemporary artists?
There's been an absolute just wonderful flourish in probably the last 15 years.
Yeah, because Diane always made that point very strong. He said, I'm alive, I'm living today.
That's right.
I respect my ancestors and their work, but I want to do who I am
That's right.
today.
That's right. It's a living culture.
Exactly.
It is a living culture. And it is mixed, and it is unique, and it is a product of the environment. But this recognition and renewal of native identity certainly is such a cultural issue that it's going to influence the art. No matter what.
Well, I love what you said somewhere, that when you were continuing the story, yes, you're creating art that was part of the cultural past, but you're continuing the story from you as an artist.
Absolutely. I think that's true of any artist. You can't remove yourself from the work.
But, you know, I guess ironically, because the masks were taken away, they were preserved.
Yes.
And do exist today.
We're actually going to celebrate Alphonse Prenard on September 30. We're going to go to France, a group of us, and we're going to dance a mask in honor. It's his 100th anniversary. We're working with the museum in Boulogne-sur-Mer, which is a wonderful little institute, Chateau Musée. I'm telling you, they have one of the most progressive staffs. They're just exciting. And, of course, they've completely rebuilt the exhibit area for the masks. They realize what they are, and it's national treasures, and they realize it's the largest single collection of Aleutic material from Kodiak, the largest collection of masks in the world, by a multiple of about 10.
Wow.
So it's really significant. But also, Prenard collected some headdresses, some beadwork. There's 3 complete headdresses, the beaded headdress, mm-hmm. with matching belts and matching cuffs, 3 sets. We don't know of any other place in the world that has that. And the exciting thing about the Prenard collection is it was all collected at one time, and the collection is still intact, which is very, very rare for a large collection. Mostly these types of collections sort of got piecemealed out and a few here and a few there. And
oh, that is so exciting. And so this was great respect.
Oh, yes. I mean, if I hold him in very, very high regard. I think that culturally, he's the most important non-native in Kodiak history from a cultural Aleutic perspective. There was a collector, a Russian collector, that also did a tremendous amount of work. I'll slaughter his name. I always do. Mm-hmm. It's Varnitsky, or that's in the ballpark. Sven Hawkinson, the executive director of the museum, is always quick to correct me. My language is terrible. But he also, in 1842, collected, and he collected masks. And now this man had a very unusual quality about him. He would not collect anything out of context. And one of the stories is he was in Old Harbor Village. A group of about 6 to 8 hunters were getting ready to leave to go on the hunt. He walked down on the beach, and he pointed at one, and he said, "That one." And the story is the man had to go home to change clothes because he wanted the entire hunting thing as the man was ready to push the kayak off. The kayak, the hunting tools, the clothes, everything.
And, was he an anthropologist as well or something?
This man was fascinating. He was sent by the Russians just for the purpose of collection. That was his job. He actually had different lists to round out certain collections. In 1842, he was in the village of Lesnoy, which is on Woody Island right across from where Kodiak is today, and he collected masks, 4 masks, from the dance that night, from the dance. Wow. And they're the only 4 masks in the world that are fully adorned as they were worn.
So no wonder people had tears in their eyes.
When I saw those masks, I'm telling you, I was just stunned. Of course, the Pinard collection had that impact on me and other artists. Sven Hawkinson organized a group that went, all 10 artists went over, and it was really emotional.
I can only imagine.
I mean, here are objects that your great-great-grandfather may have made.
Yes.
Certainly knew, understood.
Yes.
And that's the first time.
And they were so beautiful. So, I'm just running out of time. We could talk much more about this. I'm so honored and pleased to have you here, Perry. And Margie, thank you for giving us a vicarious experience.
You're most welcome. It's my pleasure to be here. And thanks to both of you for all you do for the arts community of Alaska. We are all greatly in your debt.
Thank you so very much. And join us again next month for another edition of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.